Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of the Jane Austen podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Vulgar History, a feminist women's history comedy podcast. My name is Anne Foster, and this is part two of our super special about Fredegund. And I'm going to do like sort of like a previously on Fredegund moment, but truly, if you're listening to this and you haven't heard part one yet, like, you know, you do you. I respect all of your choices. But it's going to make a lot more sense if you listen to part one first, because we're talking about a time and a place about which, prior to doing research, I knew nothing. So actually, no. So if you're like jumping into this and you actually already know all about 6th century Frankish dynasty disputes, maybe you'll get it. But anyway, part one is out there for you. This is part two. I'm going to be honest. If I get to talking and it's more than an hour and I'm not done, I'm going to cut it off and we're going to do a part three, because there's a lot to get into and I think it's helpful for all of us to take a week off in between to just like dissect what we've learned. So where we left off last time is the Frankish kingdom was in four parts and then it was in three parts. It's still in three parts, but one of the kings is dead. Well, I guess. Yeah. So basically one of the kings is dead. So we've got three kingdoms going on right now. We have Burgundy, which is being ruled over by Guntram, who is one of the original four brothers from when the kingdoms were originally like assigned to them. His deal is he doesn't have an heir, like children of his own. He has sort of taken very extreme religious vows, and so clearly he's not gonna have any more kids because of chastity reasons, abstinence reasons. So he named his nephew Childeric as his heir, and Childebert is the son of Brunhilde, and his dad was Sigebert. So Childebert is at this point I think like 11 years old, so he's like the child king of his own kingdom, which is Austrasia, which is, I mean, just side note, it sounds like one of the names of countries from like a Hallmark Christmas movie about a fake kingdom where there's like a prince who falls in love with a commoner or something, like Austrasia. It's so close to being Australia, to being Austria, to being Asia, yet not. So Austrasia is being ruled over by 11-year-old Childebert, but really it's being ruled over by his mom, Brunhilde. And then the third kingdom is Neustria, also sometimes called Soissons, I'm not sure why. And that's being ruled over by Chilperic and his wife, Fredegund. And although they were married, I get the sense it's sort of a similar thing to like a child king with his mom ruling, because Chilperic is utterly devoted to Fredegund and she's the one who's like getting shit done. So because they had like, I think, two or three sons in a row who all died of dysentery, and because they're very strict about the whole patrilineal structure of it all. Although they have a daughter named Rigunth, who we're going to learn more about this week. She obviously can't inherit because the rules are bullshit. And so they're just like, without a son, they're like, well, who's going to be the heir? And it's all like this dynastic situation. So Chilperic ended up having to name Childebert his heir as well. So presumably for a time, if Guntram and Chilperic both died, then Childebert / his mom Brunhilde would be the king of all the Frankish territories, and there would only be one king. And well, let's see if that happens. So all this happened, but less than a year after Childebert was declared the heir to Chilperic, Fredegund became pregnant again. She is now in her 30s, and she'd been having children for like, I don't even know, 20 years. And the boys all keep dying of dysentery. So this baby was a boy named Theoderic. And that's where we left last time. And I'm sorry for having to break this news to you, because the first part of this news story is that baby Theoderic also dies of dysentery during another rainy season. So just like the rain sweeps up all the poo water, and just baby boys die of dysentery. This is the third time in a row. Fredegund, I mean, still postpartum, right? With a total lack of emotional support, presumably. She was having a time of it. Like, this was her third, like, child who had died very young of the same disease. Like, she must have felt like she was under a curse. In fact, she did. So she looked around to find someone to blame. So this is sort of like, if you've watched Peaky Blinders, I don't know what the overlap is between Vulgar History listeners and watchers of Peaky Blinders, but I just watched the whole series a bit ago. And there's a part where somebody dies and a character, it's basically his fault, but he just like needs to find a reason that it's not his fault so he can move on with life. And so he talks to an old Romany woman who is just like, yes, there was the jewel that you gave your wife that was cursed. She died because of the curse. And he was like, great. It was the curse, not my fault. Moving on. So Fred is also looking, I think, to find a reason, someone to punish, basically. She wants someone to punish for this because she's really mad. She's obviously devastated. So she's looking around for someone to blame. And she heard word, or maybe she personally overheard this. She has a spy network, right? Like, whether she personally heard or somebody else did, that a courtier was talking about how he knew a cure for dysentery. And she was like, wait a minute. If there's a person here who knows a cure for dysentery, like, A, why didn't he give it to my son? And B, this is a leap, so just stay with me and Fred and remember the emotional extreme that she's in. She was like, wait, if he knows a cure for dysentery, maybe he also knows a potion that causes dysentery. Therefore, maybe he caused my son to die. So she had this guy arrested. He was tortured. And even under torture, he didn't admit to poisoning the baby prince, but he did admit to purchasing and using potions, but not for malicious reasons, just to kind of like to make friends and influence people. So Fredegund arrested the woman he named who had provided him with these potions, which were probably just like placebos. It's not just one woman. So there are various women from whom he bought these potions. They're probably healers or midwives, probably giving him some herbs. Anyway, under torture, they said what they needed to say to make the torture stop, which we all know doesn't mean that it's true. So they agreed. They said, yes, we caused the baby's death. We're witches. And then Fredegund had them executed, some by fire, some by being torn apart on a wheel, and some by drowning. And then, in her grief, Fredegund set up... Her grief is just, like, really outward pointing. So she then set up a giant pyre, like a giant pile of stuff she lit on fire, of all of baby Theoderic's possessions. So I don't know, like, his crib, I don't know, his, like, little wooden toys or whatever. So it seemed like she was just sort of like exercising the memory of him. But people didn't know why she was doing this, except they're just kind of like, Fredegund's got a Fredegund. Like, she's a woman with big emotions. Let's just let her do it. But I'll let you in on a secret that the people watching her this time didn't know, which was secretly she was pregnant again, but terrified and paranoid that this baby would also fall victim to what seemed to her like a curse. So I'm guessing she got rid of all of Theoderic's baby stuff just in case something among it was cursed, so that nothing cursed could touch her new baby. So she was secret pregnant. This is like celebrities during COVID quarantine who are just like, oh, hey, guess what? I like experienced a full pregnancy and here's my baby. My baby's a year old now. You know, she's doing like a Scarlett Johansson type pregnancy reveal here. Just like not telling anybody. I respect it. So meanwhile, while she's going through all this and she's pregnant again, like, they do have a daughter named Rigunth, who was a cool young teen and just dealing with with her younger brothers perpetually dying and with her just kind of having nothing to do, because to everybody, she was just sort of like a human bartering chip to see like what alliance could they marry her off into. And they chose to marry her off into the Visigoths, which are the people from whom Brunhilde came from. And side note, Brunhilde's daughter Ingrid had already married into them as well. So it's just kind of like making a nice little alliance. Rigunth was loaded down with a massive amount of treasure, like a weirdly large amount of treasure to bring with her as a show of how powerful and successful her parents were. And this is kind of setting the scene. But then everybody was taken by surprise when Fredegund's husband, Chilperic, was assassinated. So all we know about the assassin who escaped, apparently his name was Falco, which is a great name. And apparently as he stabbed Chilperic to death, he said out loud that this was revenge for how Chilperic had killed Sigebert. Remember, and the person who killed Sigebert was actually, were actually these two young boys who Fred, like, forced to do it with the poison knives. But anyway, so apparently this was, so it seemed like the assassin either was allied with Austrasia, which is where Sigebert used to be the king, or they wanted people to think it was Austrasia, like everyone's playing four-dimensional chess. Falco, the assassin, also used the same sort of poison steak knives as when Sigebert was killed. Decades later, a story was written down that Fredegund had been having an affair and Chilperic had found out about it and was going to have her and her lover executed. So perhaps Fredegund is the one who arranged for Chilperic's assassination, and I would not put it past her. But so if it was her, she may have gotten them to make it sound like they were from Austrasia so she could get rid of Chilperic while also framing Brunhilde, but that's one possibility. But the fact that he was like, this is for Austrasia, means that it's just as likely that Brunhilde had sent Falco. God knows she had reasons to want to kill Chilperic after he'd been responsible for the murder of her sister and her husband and of her kind of second husband, Merovech. And for putting the evidence together. So Brunhilde's ambassador had been in court, like around Chilperic a bit beforehand. So he was around and could have hired an assassin on her behalf while he was there. And then also Brunhilde and her son were kind of weirdly well positioned in the aftermath to, like, they were right there en route. So that seems also possible. We don't know who hired Falco because he escaped. You know what? This is like, I feel like the one assassin in this entire saga who actually didn't get his arms and legs ripped off afterwards or whatever. But here's the thing. I doubt that it was Fredegund who did this. Like, she knew, we'll see from her actions later on, like, being without a husband was kind of detrimental to her. And also remember, she was secretly pregnant. Nobody knew she was pregnant. So if Brunhilde had been the one who planned this assassination, she may have done it assuming that her son, Childebert, would then inherit the kingdom as heir, because remember, he had been named heir. But she didn't know that there was going to be another actual heir. So I would suggest, this was not in any of the resources, but I'm just like a bitch who likes a murder mystery. I think the killer might have been Gundevald. Do you remember? He's the other younger half-brother, and he has the support of the Byzantine Empire, and he wants to take over. Anyway, this is, I'm so sorry, a cold case. We will never know who did it, but the end result is the same no matter who it was, which is Chilperic is dead. Fredegund is a widow. Meanwhile, Rigunth and her entourage, remember they said it with like way more treasure than maybe they should have. They had been robbed en route numerous times. I think a bunch of the guards who were with her sort of were just gave up and ran away. So this was not a very victorious little entourage parade going towards Spain and the Visigoths to marry her. So while they were still en route on this kind of like doomed trip, they found out about the murder of her father, and so they stopped going to Visigoths because they weren't sure what to do. And also they had no money, and her father was dead. So she just sort of waited in a convent for a ride back home, basically. A messenger went back to Fredegund to let her know, like, hey, here's what's up. Rigunth is hiding in a convent, and also all of her treasure you gave her was stolen, and all of her guards abandoned her. Fredegund, this is before there was the saying, don't kill the messenger. Well, maybe it was because she didn't kill the messenger, but she did humiliate and berate him and blamed him for the message. And then she rounded up all the guys who were meant to have protected Rigunth and had them all beaten, plundered, and maimed for failing to protect the princess and all of her treasure. And I feel like yeah, those guys did not do a very good job. And then, so she needed a man and she needed a plan, because this was a situation in which women had, she had no power of her own. Remember, the way that the society worked was like, when you're a woman married to the king, then you have the power because you're married to him. But as soon as he dies, they're going to ship you off to a convent. Or even before he dies, if he divorces you, like, she had no power of her own. So she had to figure something out. So looking at her options, what she did is she wrote to her brother-in-law, Guntram, who's this like cranky old man who's also celibate. She knew he didn't want to get married again for abstinence reasons. And she also knew that he didn't like strong, independent women. Like, he was allied with Brunhilde, but he did not like her. And I think he'd done a thing where, like, he sent off one of his wives and she came back to try to take over. And then he, like, shipped her to a convent. Anyway, Guntram, big ol' sexist, did not like women speaking their mind. Knowing this, Fredegund, who is so smart, she wrote him a letter being like, oh no, I'm just like a poor woman who can't defend herself. Could you please come take over my country? My husband is dead and I have this surprise baby. Guntram didn't know about the baby because nobody knew about the baby because that was her whole plan. But he was like, oh my God, like, I don't care about Fredegund, but the baby is a boy and that's important to me. So he rushed over to provide his forces to protect Fredegund and the new baby king. And then just to sort of like extra make him like her, she let him choose the name for the baby. And the baby was named Clothar, which is the name of Guntram's father. And luckily, Guntram got there just before King Charibert, the 11-year-old son of Brunhilde. So they also charged over there because they were like, ooh, Chilperic's dead. We're going to take over as well. So Charibert showed up and he was like, hand over the murderess, like Fredegund, the person who killed my aunt, Gilswintha, and my father, Sigebert, and my uncle, Chilperic, and my two cousins, which were Chilperic's previous other sons. So Charibert has like reasons to want to take Fredegund to deal with her, but Guntram was Fredegund's protector now, and he was like, but she has a baby who is the king, and so I have to protect her now because she had a boy son, and that makes her matter to me. And so Fredegund was safe for now, but living with Guntram sucked because he was like this awful paternalistic older guy who wouldn't allow her to have any power, and like, I mean, he was not vibing with her. As a show of power, Guntram forced Fredegund to dine with him every night, even if she didn't want to, until one night she excused herself because I bet those dinners were like so annoying and he probably like made her not talk or something. But she was like, ugh, she excused herself saying she had to go because she was pregnant, which is like, we're gonna look at this because why would her being pregnant mean she can't join him for dinner? But more importantly, how, what? So there was, like, her husband was dead, but there were 2 months between the birth of Clothar and Chilperic's death, so she could have conceivably gotten pregnant again. But that's like a Britney Spears level, like, back-to-back pregnancy. And that was also, for their time, as well as for ours, really, it's outside the norm for people to, like, get instantly pregnant right again, especially if you're breastfeeding, etc. So, but there, culturally, women usually waited at least 8 months after giving birth to become pregnant again. I think that's based on a Bible thing, maybe, but also I think the Bible thing might be based on just, like, best practices of, like, making women have better chances of not dying. So, she was probably lying, but also, if she said she was pregnant, that meant Guntram would be less likely to turn against her, because her new alleged baby would also be an heir, so it's maybe a way to protect herself. To be clear, though, like, no baby ever came after Clothar, and nobody ever wrote about her being pregnant again, so she was probably just trying to get out of an annoying dinner situation. Or, I mean, maybe she had a miscarriage, or maybe, I don't know, it just seems to me like she was just being like, I can't deal with this dinner anymore. And they're like, well, where are you going? She's like, I'm pregnant. Peace out. But also, it sort of protected her as well, because if she was pregnant, that meant that Guntram wouldn't be able to send her to a convent, which is what he liked to do with other widowed old queens, because pregnant women can't go to convents, I guess, is the rule. And then also, although Guntram was this, like, super monk-like guy, who knows what he was really like? she might have been worried that he might try to have sex with her, but if she was pregnant, he wouldn't do that because culturally that also just wasn't a thing, and Guntram was very rule following. So she just kind of, this whole thing just bided her some time to figure her next move. But I feel like we're going to get into a series of iconic Fredegund moments, and this is but one of them. So she, and I think we know enough about her, that she was not into living this like quiet life of retirement in the countryside. The chronicler Gregory of Tours wrote, "She was very depressed because much of her power had come to an end, and yet she considered herself a better woman than Brunhilde." And she's just someone who was always striving for more and always wanted more. And she liked to have a scheme and a project and a plan. And so she wasn't just going to like hang out and do nothing. Also, it was important to her that everybody knew that she was the best. So she decided to do her favorite hobby of trying to assassinate Brunhilde again. So again, because this is work before with Sigebert, she sent a household staff member, unpaid servant, to secretly get a job at Brunhilde's palace to sort of like ingratiate himself in there. And then once he was working there, the plan was for him to kill Brunhilde. But I guess he was acting suspiciously because Brunhilde's staff noticed this guy was kind of up to no good. So they grabbed him, they tortured him, and he confessed what he was up to. Like, he literally said like, "Ooh, yeah, Fredegund sent me here to assassinate Brunhilde." To show how little she cared, like, Brunhilde didn't punish him, well, other than torturing, but she didn't like cut off his hands or whatever. She didn't kill him. She just shipped him back alive to Fredegund, just like a FedEx package, just like cash on delivery, you know. Fredegund was so mad. I mean, she's mad at Brunhilde, but I guess she's also mad at this guy who like didn't do the killing. So she had the guy's hands and feet cut off because that's just what she does. So then she's just sort of like on a little mini vengeance checklist. Fredegund went after a guy named Eberulf, who had been the royal treasurer during the Chilperic era. And she was mad at him because he'd refused to help her directly after Chilperic's assassination. Guntram agreed with this. Like, the whole trying to kill Brunhilde, Guntram maybe didn't know about it, for sure wouldn't have been behind it. But Guntram agreed with her, like, let's get rid of Eberulf for his own reasons. So Eberulf was stripped of his titles, his lands, and his fortunes. Eberulf went running off to claim sanctuary, which is the thing where, like, if you're in a church, you can't be arrested. People did that a lot in this era. They were, like, really believed in that was a rule. If you were, it's like when you're playing in the playground as your kids and you're like, if I stand in this one corner, like, no one can touch me. It's the magic corner. So Eberulf went to claim sanctuary in a church somewhere. Guntram was like, oh no. And remember, Guntram is like super like rule following slash very like biblical literalism. So he's like, well, how can we trick him to leave the church so we can arrest him? And Fredegund was like, okay. Or what if we just send someone into the church to kill him? And she did. So she sent her own man, not Guntram's man. She sent her own man into the church where a bloodbath ensued. The end result was that the guy Fredegund had sent, probably another one of these like servants, who she's like, I'm going to give you a potion to make you brave. And the potion is like wine. And then he ends up dead, but it was worth it to do it for her. So Fredegund's man ended up getting run through with a spear, but he succeeded because Eberulf's brains scattered across the church, is the description I read. As this happened, men on both sides looted the church of all of its expensive items. Guntram likely suspected Fredegund had been behind this because it was a classic Fredegund situation. Like, she did not respect the rules of sanctuary, and she always did the most. But he was too busy with other stuff to call her out or punish her. So she got away with it. Because what was he busy with? Well, the youngest half-brother, Gundevald, remember? His hair had all grown back, was launching another invasion funded by the Byzantine Empire. And he was also apparently considering, Gundevald was, considering a marriage to Brunhilde. And that made Guntram really freak out because that would freeze Guntram out of the territory owned by Brunhilde and son. So he was like, okay, I need to like really make sure that Brunhilde and her son Childebert are like super allied with me. So he had a big like public meeting. I don't know what you would call it. It was sort of like a big, I'd say it's like a photo call, but there's not cameras. But in front of everybody, had a big public meeting with Childebert, Brunhilde's son, to remind everybody that Childebert was Guntram's heir. And he was like, Childebert, you are a man now, because Childebert was 15. And here's the thing, because we see this over and over again, where there's these like powerful women, and the only way they can rule is like being the regent for their sons. And the sons are always useless and suck. And Childebert lives up to that. He just is useless. So there was this big meeting, and it was sort of a place where he could have, you know, said or done anything, but seemingly all he heard his uncle say was, you are a man now. So he went off and got a courtesan pregnant, because he's like, well, it sounds like I need to go father some children. I'm 15. Here we go. Brunhilde was not into this, because she's like, that's not what we're doing, Childebert. We're not just like having children unmarried with courtesans. So she got him married to a very easily persuadable woman who is never gonna get in her way, and this woman's name was Failuba. But also Brunhilde knew, like, she'd seen, like, her sister was dead because Fredegund had like raised herself from being not a courtesan but like a servant to being the queen. She didn't want another like Fredegund style ascent of a lower class woman, so that's why she chose Failuba. So Gundevald still running around, so he was like, well, I just really need to marry. He was widowed at this point, he had children too. He just really wanted to marry somebody to sort of like weasel his way in so he could be the king of somewhere. So he tried to see if he could marry Fredegund's daughter, Rigunth, who is still single after the whole caravan robbery situation. Fredegund herself, I don't know if he considered marrying her. Anyway, but none of this came to anything, because Guntram's forces came together, successfully killed Gundevald, so that whole threat is done. This part two episode, it's part one was like, here's like 75 people, and at the end of it, like five of them were still alive. So every time someone dies in the story, I'm just like, oh, okay, less people. Good, this gets less confusing. But Guntram was mad at Fredegund for entertaining possibly marrying Rigunth to Gundevald. So to get back at her, Guntram made public accusations that Fredegund's son, baby King Clothar, was illegitimate. If he was believed, Fredegund would be seen as an adulteress and probably a murderess. Clothar would no longer be the baby king, and Fredegund would no longer have any power at all, which she was not going to let happen. So the way that like the legal system worked in this time is that there were two ways that she could answer his accusation. So either by trial, like a court case, you know, with a judge and probably a jury of men, and everybody has to testify, or by ordeal, which I guess trial by combat type situation. But there was also a third way, less commonly used. I remember Fredegund was a very well-read, so she knew all the loopholes, all the legal loopholes. And the third way was, if she had 12 trustworthy noblemen vouch for her in public. So the thing she could do is she could have 12 trustworthy noblemen vouch for her in public. So she set about arranging this to happen for her. And she had, you remember, army of spies, like so influential. She called in every favor she had from anybody, using her supporters to find more supporters. And then the day that she was supposed to show up with, like, that she had to answer to the accusations, where she, all that was needed for was 12 noblemen to speak for her. And she marched in, not with 12 men, but with 3 bishops and 300 noblemen, all ready to say how she was the most trustworthy person. She's totally not an adulteress. They were all like, all 303 of us can all guarantee Clothar is totally not illegitimate. And in the face of this, Guntram had to admit defeat. He obviously wasn't happy about it, but just tally that up for like Fredegund icon status. Meanwhile, she can't stop trying to kill Brunhilde. So she was found out. Guntram found out that she was yet again trying to kill Brunhilde, because Guntram intercepted a letter in which her plans to assassinate were discussed. I want to make it clear, this was not Fredegund's letter. It was not from her, because she was too smart to let her letters be intercepted. someone else wrote to her, or someone else wrote about it. So Guntram intercepted this letter and he gave a heads up to Brunhilde and Child de Burt. And because of this heads up, they found two clerics armed with swords with special grooves in them to hold poison, like special swords with built-in poison pockets, because Fredegund was like leveling up her methods of using poison knives. These two men were tortured, mutilated, and killed. And throughout all of this, Fredegund was still stuck in this house in Rouen. And the thing about Rouen is that the bishop of Rouen at the time was her old enemy and everyone's favorite name, Praetaxtatus. So how did he get back here? So the thing is that Praetaxtatus had been, he was a bishop, and then he stopped being a bishop. He was like de-bishoped by Chilperic, I think, because of how he had been found to be secretly funding Gundevald. But then he, after Chilperic died, he was like, ooh, maybe I can go back in. He came back and he was like, I'm going to be a bishop. Can I be a bishop again? And Guntram was like, okay, even though Fredegund was like, he is my mortal enemy. Guntram's like, I'm a man and I know better. So anyway, Praetaxtatus is back in the scene. So he was a bishop, then he wasn't a bishop. Now he's a bishop again. And he would like make fun of Fredegund, being like, you know, maybe I was a bishop and then I was not a bishop, but I'm a bishop again. But you were a servant and you'll never, and like, if you're not going to always be a royal because you used to be a servant. So like, you're going to be a servant again one day, basically. Which is like bold of him to be mocking Fredegund after we've seen literally everything about her. But also, this was like, do you know in the second and third Back to the Future movies where there's this thing where when someone calls Marty McFly chicken, he just like loses all sense of logic and reason and he'll do anything foolhardy because he like can't bear to be called chicken. So this is her Achilles heel. Whenever anyone reminded her about her non-royal beginnings and the possibility that she could be cast aside once her son came of age because she herself was not technically royal, that was just like, she would go loco. And so it will not surprise you to know that she set about planning to murder Praetaxtatus. So we've already established that she does not have any respect for the sanctity of churches. So she went for an assassin to come into the Easter Mass. So like, remember there, like this is a Christian situation. So during the Easter Mass, so Praetaxtatus was just standing up at the front, like being the bishop, doing the Mass. And like, as he's like literally in the church giving the Mass, this guy ran up and stabbed him in the armpit, which is an interesting place to stab somebody. I can't emphasize how shocking this would have been to everybody, because churches, it's not just like that's the place you go for sanctuary when you like don't want to be arrested, but it's just kind of like a church is a place, like it's sacred to them. Not to Fredegund. She's just like, everyone thinks a church is sacred. Great. That's where I'm going to like assassinate the bishop. So she sent in a guy, pretexted to stab in the armpit, but guess what? Did not kill him. Everyone just kind of stood and or sat there watching this happen. Like the other bishops who were there, who were, I'm going to guess, paid off by Fredegund, didn't like rush up to help him. But eventually some parishioners helped him and they like carried him into his bed because I guess hospitals weren't invented yet. So he's just sort of like in the bed, like bleeding out, I guess. And Fredegund came to visit. This is why, like icon status. And she's like, oh my God, Praetaxtatus, you've been stabbed in church. How awful. I hope whoever the assassin is gets caught soon. And Praetaxtatus was like, I think we both know who is behind this. And she was like, want me to send my personal doctors to help you? And he's like slowly bleeding out and dying. Just like, no, I don't want your personal doctors, AKA probably also assassins. And then he's like, and also you are a murderer, Fredegund. And he listed all the people who he allegedly thinks that she killed, which he was probably right. And then he cursed her for the rest of her days, but she gave no fucks and left. And he died the next day. So like, mission accomplished. So the people of Rouen were freaked out that a bishop was, you know, assassinated in the middle of Easter Mass, which is like fair enough to be freaked out about that. So the town leaders, I'm not sure how many there are, let's assume like three of them, came to Fred again to be like, we know this was you. And she was like, let's talk about this over dinner. And they were like, probably not, because you're probably going to poison our food or whatever. And she's like, okay, but do you want to accept this traditional Frankish drink? And this is a detail I'm going to give you that may or may not explain everything about everyone's behavior throughout this entire story, because the traditional Frankish drink was absinthe mixed with wine and honey, which is quite a beverage. I know there's other history podcasts where they like invent a mixed drink to like drink based on every story. And if I was that sort of podcast, that's what I would do. Absinthe, wine, and honey. If they're just drinking that instead of water, then like, of course everyone's behaving in this assassination-y way. They're all just like drunk/high/on a sugar rush constantly. Anyway, so she gave him this drink and he's like, well, of course I'll accept a drink of absinthe, wine, and honey from you. Like, that's just a thing we do here. We're the Franks. But obviously it was poisoned. And as he drank it, he's like, oh, fuck, it's poisoned. And he warned the other town leaders to run away. But they were caught as they ran away and they were all killed. So, but you can't just like murder everyone like this. So the church itself set out to investigate. Like, if we're keeping track, she had killed the bishop and then the town leaders. So they wanted to find out the dirt on Fredegund. So to persuade the people of Rouen to tattle on Fred, like to be snitches, the church banned baptisms, marriages, and burials in town. And so that made people give in because people wanted to have baptisms, marriages, and burials. Basically, the church went on strike. And so everybody pointed the fingers. They're like, yeah, Fredegund was behind everything. Guntram, you're like, where is this guy? He's busy with war, etc. But he did send a message that he's like, Fredegund, please don't install a new bishop because I'll do that. That's my job. But Fredegund, I mean, surprise, installed a new bishop because obviously she also presented a servant who claimed to have been the assassin. And she, you know, she's just like, hey, I've like solved this whodunit. Here's the assassin. It's this random servant. And she's like, so sorry, pray Tacitus family, like do whatever you want with this guy. So I guess they decided to torture this guy, and under torture, this guy said, Fredegund had paid him to do all this, and then he was executed. And I guess that kind of like is like, well, that's all wrapped up because her murderous power play had worked. By 546, she was the undisputed leader of the kingdom of Neustria. She was the regent for her infant son, Clothar. Guntram cut out of the area entirely. And I don't entirely follow the trajectory of how that came about, but I guess it just had to do with her. Everyone was so terrified of her. They were like, okay, I guess. Oh, and then also like she chose the new bishop and the bishop was like, I'm going to say Fredegund is fine because he was the bishop who she had chosen. So anyway, all of which to say, by 546, Fredegund is in charge of Neustria as the regent to her infant son. Brunhilde is still kind of the power behind Austrasia, and Guntram, like all of those alliances they had between each other. Now it's just kind of like three kingdoms who all hate each other, all going on. So here's a little side story for you. It's about Fredegund's daughter, poor Rigonth, who just like... So she survived all of, like, her baby brothers kept dying, and she had no power because the society was not a society in which teenage princesses had any power, which is unfortunate, obviously, in every society. Anyway, Rigonth sounds like she was really cool. She was a lot more like her mother than either of them would ever admit, and that led to them fighting a lot physically. So, quick recap. So Rigonth had been betrothed to this Visigoth prince in Spain, but then her like entourage was robbed and the news of her father's assassination reached her. So when we last left her, she was waiting in a convent to get a ride home, effectively, because the marriage to the Visigoth prince had fallen apart. Eventually she was brought to live with Fredegund in Rouen. And these two just, like, hated each other Or, more accurately, Rigunth hated Fredegund, and Fredegund was like, well, what have I ever done to you except for, like, never pay attention to you or love you? So, I mean, Fredegund was so busy birthing and then mourning baby sons that she never paid much attention to Rigunth. Also, just to note that in this patrilineal society, so Rigunth couldn't be the heir, so she was inherently less important except just as someone to marry off. And the whole, there's a lot of problems, but one major problem with a patrilineal society is that if you look at statistically throughout all of time and history, girls in general are often healthier than boys. Girl babies tend to survive better than boy babies. Like, how many stories have we done on this podcast where it's like, oh no, and then the baby who's the heir died? Like, girl babies are just more resilient, and that's what's so dumb about building a society about where girls can't do anything. So, Rigunth just had this sort of sense of uselessness and pointlessness, which kind of makes sense because everyone was just like, no one cares about you. You don't matter. We're just going to send you off to marry somebody. JK, you're not going to marry that guy. All of the guards abandoned you. And now you're just going to like live in this castle with your mother who hates you. So she was like well-educated based on the charisma of her parents, probably gorgeous, very charismatic. Is this also a thing where it's like, we have the women who are amazing and then their sons like killing themselves over to give their sons power and the sons are useless. I think the daughters are often cool and it's just like, ugh, so frustrating. So Rigunth is just this cool young teen, bored all the time. And to like find something to do, she just flirted shamelessly with every man she came into contact with. And I feel like hats off to you, Rigunth. You know, teenage version of a tits out life. Fredegund was like, please stop flirting with every man. This is going to ruin your marriage prospects. And Rigunth is like, what marriage prospects? I am a teenage unmarried woman. And then she knew the one thing that she could say to most hurt her mother, which is the Marty McFly thing. Fredegund's sensitivity about having been born a commoner and having been a slave. So she would just be like, you know, I'm royal by blood. You're just a servant. Like, one day you're just going to be a servant again. And then, you know, that just, again, I mean, it's bold of anyone to stand up to Fredegund like this after we've seen how many people she can assassinate. But I guess when it's your daughter, she's just kind of like, screw you, mom. So their arguments were screaming matches, sometimes physical altercations with slaps and punches. And then most famously, during one of these fights, Fredegund pretended to be tired of arguing and was like, you know what, Rigunth, like, come with me. So they go into a room with a giant treasure chest full of Rigunth's father's old treasure, Chilperic's treasure. And Fredegund was like, Rigunth, you can take any of your father's old treasures with you and do whatever you want with them. And Rigunth is like, okay, I guess this is like a peace offering or whatever. So she knelt down and leaned over to like look in the treasure chest to see what she's going to take. And you better believe that her mother, Fredegund, slammed the lid of the treasure chest on her daughter's neck. The servants in the room began freaking out because this was not an accident. Like, this was not just trying to injure her. Like, Fredegund was attempting to murder her daughter via the lid of a treasure chest. Rigunth's eyes were bulging. She couldn't breathe. Fredegund was just like pushing harder and harder. Eventually, one of Rigunth's servants ran to the hall for help. More attendants came out, and they pulled Fred away and helped Rigunth get some fresh air. And so, like, parenting tips from Fredegund, apparently. And also, that's the last we ever hear about Rigunth, so I do not know what happened to her after that. Although, if Fredegund had successfully killed her, I think that would have been recorded. So, I don't even know. I'm going to guess at this point Fredegund sent Rigunth to go off, live in a convent, because that's just what you did in this era with inconvenient girls and women. So the next part of this in my notes is called Fredegund's Warrior Queen Era. So hold on to your tits. Here we go. So the thing is that Guntram was still stomping around trying to steal land from Fredegund, because this whole thing is just like, they're so focused on just each other. It's like, here's these three kingdoms, and all that they're doing is trying to steal land from each other. Like, it's very self-contained. They're not trying to, like, get more land anywhere. They're just like, this is our land. these are the three Frankish kingdoms, and we're just going to keep trying to steal it from each other, is all that's happening. So the thing is, Fredegund was not just like expert at innovating swords with poison pockets in them and, you know, unconventional parenting tips. She had some real good military prowess. So I think part of this is just, she's just like a smart person who can like figure things out other people don't think about. I think also part of it is from all of her book learning. Like she read about the Romans, and maybe from growing up as potentially a Celtic person, she knew some of their stuff too. So she had some really cool military ideas. And you know me, if you listen to this podcast, if you listen to this part two episode, like I'm not generally, I don't care about the details of battles. That's like other people do that. God bless. But the way that Fredegund fought battles is like really interesting. So, for instance, there's a place, an area, a people called the Bretons. So right now we know Bretons as, there's Breton crackers. There's also, you know how the stereotypical like modern day French people wear the like black and white horizontal stripe shirts? Like that's called a Breton stripe. Anyway, so there's a Breton king named Warach, and Fredegund teamed up with him to help fight off Guntram's invading forces. She knew that she couldn't send her troops to help Warach because then Guntram would know that she was behind this, and she didn't want Guntram to know that she had teamed up with the Bretons. So instead, she got her army to disguise themselves to look like the Bretons. What did the Bretons look like? Well, you remember how the Franks had the like distinctive long hair and the like combed nose hair mustaches? So the Bretons also had a distinctive hairstyle that was shorter, so she got all of her men to cut off their hair, which was like a big ask in a society and a culture where long hair was so important. But then she also got her men to dress in the same distinctive style as the Bretons, and history does not record what the Bretons' distinctive clothes were, but I have to imagine horizontal black and white stripes. So Guntram, and they won. Guntram never knew that she was involved because her troops just looked like more Bretons and their side won. So this is what I mean. She's just like, she thinks beyond what other people are thinking of. But then as keeps happening due to, I don't like, are you in France? Have you been to France, modern day France? Like, is there still floods all the time? Because during this era, and we know this for sure because Gregory of Tours was writing these chronicles, and he just like wrote down the weather very faithfully, and it's just like rain for, it feels like 25 years, just like rain, floods, dysentery. So due to floods, this weirdly long rainy period, Fredegund's bad luck, and a lack of understanding of communicable diseases, her remaining son Clothar got dysentery, the same thing that had killed his older brothers. And just imagine being her and the same goddamn thing happens to yet another son just when you're on a role of like being this warrior queen. So she's fought this in different ways. Remember one time she burned the tax records and forgave all the tax debts. Last time she killed the guy, the midwives who with the potions, she burned all of her baby stuff. So she's just like, you know, it's sort of like what we're experiencing now with pandemic times. Like when something is so out of your control, when anything is out of your control, it's like the only way, like it sort of helps with my anxiety, at least to think like, what can I control? And that is why, if you see me, I've gotten a number of tattoos and piercings since the pandemic began. I also got a haircut. I'm just like, what can I control? Anyway, so Fredegund was like, what can I control? Like in the face of just, it seems like God's wrath. So she gave a massive donation to the church. She interceded to have some enemy soldiers freed, but her son got worse and worse, like to the point that this poor little baby, funeral planning started because he so obviously was going to die. This is just like devastating, not just like to her as a mother, but also to her as a regent. And like, what does this mean for like the kingdoms? But then this time the fever broke and he survived. And this all seemed to cause sort of like an aha moment for Fredegund, because she realized like if he died, all was lost. And even worse, Brunhilde would likely come and take over her territory. So dealing with her emotions in the only way she knew how, and this had worked out well for her before, She turned all of her rage outwards towards her sister-in-law and came out with her most audacious plan yet to assassinate Brunhilde and Childebert. And this is where the whole thing is just starting to give me like Roadrunner Wile E. Coyote feels, because she just keeps trying and Brunhilde just keeps not being assassinated, but Fredegund will not stop trying. So as per ever, she used household staff / servants / enslaved people as her assassins. And the thing about this, so the fact that she kept getting these sorts of people to, like, instead of sending soldiers, she sent like household staff. Why? So the thing is, so many kings in this era, in all around Europe, killed their rivals all the time, constantly, but they did it with invading armies and like on the battlefield and wars. Fredegund preferred to work in the shadows, maybe because she wasn't 100% confident in her soldiers' loyalty, like that they would do what she wanted, but also because of her past, she knew how to relate to household staff. She knew what was important to them. She knew, and maybe they trusted her because they saw that she was sort of like a local girl done good. And I believe she would offer them money if they succeeded, which was a better option to them than continuing on being a slave. And, you know, we've talked about several of them were caught and then murdered. But, like, for instance, that guy Falco, like, he was not caught. Like, if you succeeded, then, like, your whole world can change. So it was worth it to them. And she was clearly very persuasive and charismatic in general. She also apparently gave them, I think I said this before, but I'll explain a bit better. She apparently, when she had convinced them to do this, she would give them what she claimed was a magic potion to make them more confident, which was probably just wine, but which had a placebo effect and made them more likely to do it. So in this instance, she sent 12 servant assassins, 6 to kill Childebert and 6 to kill Brunhilde. And so the plan, I think, again, just using like the fact that everyone except for her respected the boundaries of churches, the one guy was supposed to kill Childebert in his private chapel while he was praying. But while he was in his private chapel praying, he noticed a man hiding in the shadows. This guy admitted he had been sent by Fredegund to kill him, but he said he couldn't go through with it. This guy was just kind of standing there having like a panic attack, basically. And I feel for this guy. He just like could not do it. And then he tattled on the other 11. So Childebert had a search around the town and around the palace, and they found the other 11. So all 12 were caught. Of the 12, some had died by suicide by the time they were found, because they just knew they would be tortured or murdered and wanted to avoid that. Others died in custody, I'm guessing from torture-related injuries. Those who survived were mutilated, like they had their hands, feet, nose, and or ears cut off. So they would be objects of ridicule, and that would just remind everybody to not try to kill Childebert. Her plans foiled again. Fredegund was like, okay, you know, I'm going to just like take a moment before I try killing them again, and I'm going to focus on some other stuff. She focused on what was going on in her own kingdom of Neustria, namely assassinating all of her rivals at home, you know, just to like, this is her hobby and she's good at it. And here we go. So who are her rivals at home? So the thing is, because her son Clothar was at this point like 7, the boy king, she suspected, probably correctly, that some people had secret plans to try and get rid of him and her, and she would not let that happen. So, and the way that she made that not happen is by just sort of being as ferocious as possible and reminding people to not fuck with her. So one of her jobs as regent was to oversee sort of like small claims court sort of thing, which is important to note because Brunhilde also did that in her kingdom. And both of this is a big deal for both of them, because before them, Frankish women never got to be the judge type person in the situations. They were both like breaking this glass ceiling of like Judge Judy type stuff. So in Fred's kingdom, there was this family feud going on. So it was all within one family. It's not like a Montagues and Capulets, Hatfields and McCoys thing. It's like just one family, but all different branches of the family. And they all kept killing each other. And she kept trying to intercede and being like, bring it to me. Like, I'll be your mediator. I'll find a resolution. But they kept avoiding her presumably because she's a woman and they didn't respect her, which is a dangerous way to be. So eventually she was like, okay. She invited the three heads of this family to dinner. And they had a great meal and even started to get along. And their servants started to fall asleep because the party had been going on for so long. I'm assuming they're all drinking their absinthe wine honey drink. And if you're thinking like, well, Fredegund has like promised as a mediator, you know, food brings people together. No, you are wrong. Because late into the meal, she gave a signal to her servants and the three men with axes came out and beheaded these three guests, like fuck around and find out. So this solved the issue of the warring family in that they were dead now. There were other guests at this party, by the way. It wasn't just Fredegund and these three guys. So it was just like Fredegund, these three guys, some others. The others all just kind of like slowly peaced out, left the room, presumably at this reminder that Fredegund was not someone to fuck around with. So she, you know, small scale, she like solved this family dispute by killing them all. But larger scale, this just kind of reminded everybody just like, don't fuck around with Fredegund. Like, do not conspire against her. Like, she will find out and she does not hesitate to bring out men with axes. And you know what? I'm going to leave us there because we're getting close to it being an hour, and I think that's a good length of episode. And I want you to be able to really think about what we've learned. Get excited for part three, will be the last part because we're going to get into the end of it all, but also we're going to get into the scoring, which I'm it's funny that I'm just like, I can't wait to see how she scores, where it's like, and you invent the scores yourself randomly. But I can't wait to see how she scores. Like, the highest anyone has ever gotten on the show thus far, Queen Margot got a 37.5 out of 40. And as one of my friends on Instagram said, like, if anyone is going to get a perfect score, like, seems like it should be Fredegund. Like, who has ever done as much as her ever? But we're going to wait and see. So I'm going to leave it at that for part two. Tune in next week for part three, the exciting conclusion. And so I cannot recommend highly enough The Dark Queens, The Bloody Rivalry That Forged the Medieval World by Shelley Puhak, which is a dual biography of Fredegund and Brunhilde. So that's where I got so much of my information from. She helped me form some of my hot takes about what may or may not have been going on. But also, if you read the book, it's got much more about Brunhilde, who was absolutely a star as well. It's just, we're looking at this, I approach this myself from a Team Fred point of view, so that's how I'm viewing it. But Brunhilde, how many times has she foiled assassination attempts? Tits out queen herself as well. Super recommend that book. You can find that book, or links to pre-order that book, and links to all the other books I've used in this podcast at the page on bookshop.org. The links are in the show notes, but it's bookshop.org/shop/vulgarhistory. I have my little Patreon, which is patreon.com/AnnFosterWriter. And that's where if you pledge as little as $1 a month, you can get access to some extra content there. And so one thing that I've just changed or added to the Patreon also is anyone. So if you pledge, there's like different tiers. It's like $1 a month, $2 a month, $5 a month. And the $1 and $2 a month people and the $5 a month people, everybody gets access to episodes of Vulgar History a few days early. So that's a special treat for you. People at the $5 a month tier, they get the extra, even when I'm on hiatus, I do at least one extra mini episode per month called So This Asshole, where I talk about various men, and the people on the Patreon vote for which men they want to hear me talk about. The one I did last month was Philip the First of Spain, and it ended up being like an hour and a half long because there was a lot to say about him. So I say mini episode, but they're also sometimes very long. Anyway, in the Teespring store, for which there is a link in the show notes, or there's a link from my Instagram, I wanted to mention that there is new-ish tits out merch, like literally shirts and things that say tits out on them. And I wanted to mention that there's some discount codes one can use. So if you're in the US, you can use code TITSOUT for free shipping. or if you're not in the US, you can use the code TITSOUT10 for 10% off. So you can check that out. And what else? On Instagram, I'm at Vulgar History Pod. That seems to be where I'm spending more of my time than on Twitter. But I still love you out there on Twitter, where I'm at Vulgar History. And I'm really excited. You know, is this a season? Like, I was just going to do a super special about Fred again, but it's turned into 3 episodes. So I feel like, is this a season of the podcast? I don't know. Fuck around and find out. So, mask on, tits out. Talk to you next time.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.